How did a South London car dealer become one of the world's most recognisable TV presenters? Find out from this week's guest, Mike Brewer. I spoke to him on Skype from California, and he told me about something that happened with his show, Wheeler Dealers, that turned some of the people who watch it against him.
For some reason, I was the person they wanted to use as a punch bag. So I got a lot of insults and threats, and it's still happening today. You know, when I look at my social media today, I'll have people saying very nasty expletives to me and very nasty words to me. But that's part of being in public life. I accept that. And these people aren't really fans of the show.
This is London Calling.
I'm Graham Mack. Hear more from Mike Brewer in a bit. But first of all, let's have a look at what's been going on in Britain this week. Well, it was like a zombie apocalypse. That's how one Twitter user described scenes at London's Stansted Airport yesterday. It was chaotic. Some passengers even fainted. It was all because an X-ray machine had broken down. It took nearly 4 hours to fix it. Stansted is the fourth busiest airport in the UK. It's used by an average of 67,000 passengers every day. Here's the thing, though. In all the years since passenger security checks have been brought in, the staff at Stansted have not found a single passenger carrying anything that could be used to bring down a plane. Good news, though. Although hundreds of people were stranded at Stansted yesterday and a lot of them missed their flights, during that time of crisis, not a single drop of shampoo, mouthwash, or bottled water made it onto an aircraft. And there wasn't one reported incident of an angry passenger getting into a heated discussion with a security guard over whether toothpaste, jam, or hair gel are liquids. So, it wasn't all bad news. We should all be eating bugs. That's according to researchers at the University of Edinburgh. They found that replacing half of the world's meat consumption with the consumption of crickets and mealworms could cut farmlands by one third, and this would help reduce greenhouse gases and stave off climate change. You ever eaten a bug? Sarah.
I did eat an insect once. It was a very posh insect. Someone bought it for me from Selfridges. It was about like £6 in like a little box. It was a scorpion or something like edible scorpion.
And it was a real scorpion. It wasn't one made of sugar or something, no?
No. It was a real edible scorpion. Tiny thing.
Yeah.
About as big as 50p.
Yeah.
And when I say I ate it, I kind of bit the end of the tail.
And what did it taste like?
Nothing, really. It was just crunchy. Just crunchy.
Right. Okay. Would you recommend eating bugs?
Well, they're very crunchy. So as I say, if you were going to eat them, you probably wouldn't eat them instead of like a juicy steak or something like that. Maybe instead of crisps or...
Right, nice bag of scorpions instead of a bag of cheese and onion. Yeah.
Absolutely, completely different texture.
Oh, cheers. Thanks, Sarah. You want flies with that? I'm sorry. The British media are royal sycophants. The royals can do no wrong. They can get away with anything. The best example of this is how they report the news of the racist, sexist Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, the Queen's husband. He announced he's retiring from public engagements this week. That's great news and should be welcomed by anyone who hates bigots. If any other public figure said the things that he's come out with over the years, the media would be outraged. But because it's Prince Philip, they describe what he says as quips and gaffes. Here's just a few of the things Prince Philip has said in public. Here's what he said in 1986 to a group of British students during a royal visit to China. He said, "If you stay here much longer, you'll all be slitty-eyed." In 1993, he said to a Brit he met in Hungary, "You can't have been here that long. You haven't got a pot belly." In 1994, he said to a wealthy islander in the Cayman Islands, "Aren't most of you descended from pirates?" In 1995, the Duke of Edinburgh asked a Scottish driving instructor, "How do you keep the natives off the booze long enough to pass the test?" In 1999, talking to a group of young deaf people in Cardiff who were standing near a steel band, he said, "Deaf? If you're near there, no wonder you're deaf." In 1999, he was on a tour of a factory in Scotland, pointed to an old-fashioned fuse box and said, "It looks as if it was put in by an Indian." In 2001, when a 13-year-old called Andrew Adams told him he wanted to go into space, Prince Philip said, "You're too fat to be an astronaut." In 2002, talking to an Aborigine performer in Australia, he said to him, "Still throwing spears?" 2010, he's talking to the Scottish Conservative leader, Annabel Goldie. He pointed to some tartan and asked her, "Do you have a pair of knickers made out of this?" 2012, he's on a Jubilee visit to Bromley in Kent. He said to a 25-year-old council worker, Hannah Jackson, "I would get arrested if I unzipped that dress." 2013. And I think for me, this is the worst one of all. He spoke to Malala Yousafzai. She survived an assassination attempt by the Taliban and now campaigns for the rights of girls to go to school without fear. She's addressed the United Nations. She's won the Nobel Peace Prize. Prince Philip said to her, "Children go to school because their parents don't want them at home." Are these really quips and gaffes? The British media go to town on Donald Trump. The Daily Telegraph even had a thing called the Donald Trump Sexism Tracker. But Prince Philip, oh, he's a royal. He can do and say whatever he likes. Well, he might be a prince, and he might be a duke, but he's also a knob. Stop the show. I've got a great idea for a new game. I give you a phrase, and you have to tell me whether that was something that was said by Donald Trump or the Duke of Edinburgh. The game is Donald or Duke. Jane's on the phone from North Yorkshire. Here comes your phrase, Jane. Who asked a 24-year-old sea cadet, "Do you work in a strip club?" Donald or Duke?
Well, it's a bit seedy, and Donald Trump's a bit seedy.
Yes.
So, looking at his family, some of them anyway. So, I'm going to go Donald.
You're saying Donald said that? It's the wrong answer. The correct answer is the Duke of Edinburgh.
Oh, oh, I,
He said this is it was in 2010. He was talking to Elizabeth Rendell, a 24-year-old Barnstable Sea cadet. He said, "Do you work in a strip club?"
Priceless. He is
a. Join us again next time for my new experimental game, Donald or Duke. Blasphemy. I thought that was only a crime in backward-assed Middle Eastern countries. But no. The actor and comedian Stephen Fry is under police investigation for blasphemy in Ireland. A member of the public contacted authorities after Stephen Fry spoke about God during an interview with the Irish broadcaster RTE. Blasphemy is an offence under Ireland's Defamation Act of 2009. That's right, 2009. If you're found guilty, you can be fined up to €25,000. The complaints related to Fry's interview with Gay Byrne on The Meaning of Life, he was asked about what he might say to God if he met him.
You walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as theodicy, I think, I'll say bone cancer in children. What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac. Utter maniac. Totally selfish.
That's defamation in Ireland, according to one person who complained. For thousands of years, religious people have fought for freedom and the right to worship and preach whatever they want without persecution. Shouldn't those of us who don't believe in their imaginary friend get the same rights too? In Ireland, there's a law that makes it illegal to say what you think about something that's never been proved. It's that kind of closed-minded thinking that had Salman Rushdie hiding out for years, Danish cartoonists fearing for their lives, and why the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo was attacked by people armed with assault rifles who shot and killed 12 people and injured 11 others. And if there is a God, and he really is bothered about what Stephen Fry has to say, won't he deal with Stephen Fry himself? If this God is so powerful and almighty, why does he need help from the Irish police? Would your mum notice if a picture of you that hangs on her wall had been replaced with a picture of somebody else? Well, a son in Derby in the East Midlands of England has pranked his mother by changing a framed portrait of himself on the wall in her house to a picture of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. It's been 2 weeks now, and she still hasn't noticed. Which I think makes the prank even better. What's the best prank you've ever pulled? Keith?
I've got a good one for you, mate.
Yeah?
About 10 years ago, I lived on a busy road in Cowes on the Isle of Wight, and on April Fool's Day, I decided to make a fake speed camera. It took me about a week to make it, and then I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah?
Took it up the road, cable tied it to a post outside the local children's playgroup.
Now, describe it to me. This is a giant box, then?
Yeah. I got some grey soil pipe, made a big pole for it.
Yeah.
And then made a yellow box, painted it, put hazard tape around the sides, and then I used a CD as the main lens, and a Marks and Spencer's jam jar lid as a smaller lens. Right. And instead of having a Gatso on the bottom corner, it said, got you so.
Yes.
Made the local press and everything. But the funniest thing is I stuck up about 4:30 in the morning, sat in the park with my dogs watching these cars hit their brakes and slow down.
Yeah.
Went back at 11 o'clock in the morning with a couple of my workmates to show them and have a laugh.
Yeah.
And at the top of the hill, just looking down on it, was a police car, and the two policemen sat in it were just rolling around with laughter, watching all the cars hammer down the road and hit the brakes.
Are the Russians ready to invade us? There was a Russian submarine in the English Channel on the weekend. The Royal Navy ship HMS Somerset spotted it off the east coast of the UK on Friday morning and followed it through the Strait of Dover. Last month, Somerset's sister ship, HMS Sutherland, escorted two Russian warships that sailed close to UK waters. And the Russians keep doing this. RAF jets keep getting scrambled to keep an eye on Russian military planes that fly close to the UK. In February, Typhoons were deployed to monitor two nuclear-capable Tupolev Tu-160 Blackjack bombers. A lot of people are worried about what the Russians are up to. Well, if they're trying to mount a sneak attack, they're rubbish at it. Their planes always fly past in daylight. And that submarine was spotted on the surface. All Vladimir Putin is doing is showing off. Those planes and this submarine wanted to be seen. They were posing. That wasn't a periscope. That was a middle finger. The pound is collapsing. I'm not talking about how its value's dropped against the dollar since Brexit. I'm talking about how the new pound coins are falling to bits. The new super secure pound coins are losing their middle bit. The silver centre is dropping out and becoming separate to the gold-coloured ring around it. Some say the coins are coming apart on their own because of a fault at the Royal Mint. But there's a lot of online discussions that explain how to take the middle bit out. You can use a mechanical punch, freeze the middle, or heat the outer ring. If you want to get the middle bit out of a new pound coin, it can be done. This is good news. The pound has dropped in value a lot since Brexit, and now we can get our money back by separating the two bits and selling them on eBay. Pound coins with the middle bit missing are listed on eBay for up to £100 each. Let's meet this week's guest. It's Mike Brewer. He's a British car trader turned presenter of motoring television programmes. Right now he presents Wheeler Dealers on the Discovery Channel, which is shown all over the world. He's a busy bloke. We hooked up on Skype and I started by asking him, where are you right now?
I'm travelling along the freeway in San Francisco. Fortunately, I'm not driving. Michelle's behind me and I've got my producer driving.
Fantastic. So I'm getting a slice of life here.
You are. Yeah, we're on our way to a filming location. So I do apologise. I have kind of a hectic lifestyle and I do apologise if we break up at any time.
So where are you based these days? Where's home?
Home for me is Southern California. It's a lovely part of the world. It's called Newport Beach. It's next door to where we make the show Wheeler Dealers, which is at Huntington Beach.
Now, Huntington Beach, isn't that where the Beach Boys and Hot Rods are from? Isn't that that area?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the surf capital of the world. It was a great place to put our show because that area is just full of car fabricators, car customizers, interior fabricators, metal workers, So it was a great place. So when you're in a hot rod capital of the world, you've just got everything at your fingertips. So that's why we base the show there.
And what do you like most about living in America?
The Americans, they're fantastic. It's always lovely to be in America because it's the only place in the world, I'll be honest with you, where when I meet an American who recognizes me from the show, they will congratulate me on the success of the show. Where, you know, if I was somewhere else in the world, they'd probably just moan at me that I'm not doing the right job. But here in America, you always get somebody across the road to congratulate you, and I love that.
So it's a very positive kind of culture, isn't it, compared to Britain? Not that there's anything wrong with Britain, but they do seem a lot more positive.
Yeah, I think we've got a culture in England where you build people up, and once you make them successful, you do knock them down. I've had a little bit of that in the past. But here in America, no, people have got this very positive attitude, and that's true in the sense of the programme. When I'm buying cars off of people or selling cars to people, it's full of positivity. There's no skullduggery or hiding behind damage on a car or trying to hide the history of a car. It's all very positive, and it's a lovely place to do business, I'll be honest with you.
What do you miss most about Britain though?
Brown sauce. Who wouldn't miss brown sauce? I miss my daddy's sauce about Britain. No, that's a lie. What I miss about Britain most of all is my family. I've got a big family. I come from a big family, and I made a lot of sacrifices to come and make this show in America. My mother's not been very well, so it wasn't good for me to leave my family at this time. But they are 100% behind me. They give me their full support, and they want to see their brother and their son succeed and do well. And I think they're very proud of me. So I do miss them awfully. I also miss my daughter, who's at university back in England. I think they all know it's worth the sacrifice.
I want to touch on family a little bit later on, but there's an elephant in the room that I'd like to just clear up right now. Ed China's left Wheeler Dealers. What happened there?
Ed left mentally, I think, a few years ago. He's not wanted to do the show for a few years. But it was late in the last season 13, that Ed decided he really didn't want to do it anymore for no other reason than he wants to go and work elsewhere. He wants to spread his wings and do other things. So he left in July last year, and it's taken us from July to now to find a really good replacement. We already knew who that person was going to be, but we had to secure that. We've got this guy called Ant Anstead. He's a master car builder. He builds cars for a living. He's a fantastic a person. You know, we get on very well. We've become very good buddies. And Ant's incredibly excited about the prospect of what we got coming up.
I've met Ant. He's a great bloke. He was a guest. He came down when I was in Stevenage. I did a podcast with Amy Stevenson, and this was long before this news broke. He was still doing For the Love of Cars. And he's a terrific bloke. And I got the feeling from him that he's a lot like you, that he's very driven.
He is incredibly driven, and I think that's going to come across on screen. You know, both me and Ed China have always said Wheeler Dealers isn't about us. It's about the cars. We're not the stars of the show. The car is the star of the show. And Ant is very much like that. He's incredibly driven to just produce the best product he can, the best car he can. And that's the same for me. I know that I get recognised wherever I go in the world, and people think I'm some kind of a celebrity, but I'm truthfully not. I just love the cars. I love restoring cars, putting them back on the road. And me and Ant share that same passion, and we're both driven to that same end. So I gather that's going to come across on screen, and we're going to end up with some amazing programmes.
Was there a backlash when it was announced that Ed was leaving?
Yeah, it was kind of incredible. There was a lot of backlash from social media. People, for some reason, even though Ed never mentioned the fact that it was anything to do with me, it was a decision he made on his own. I'll be honest with you, Ed didn't even tell me he was leaving, so I had no choice in the matter. I got backlash on social media from people that got angry, lashed out. For some reason, because I'm carrying on with the show that I've dedicated 13 years of my life to, for some reason, I was the person they wanted to use as a punch bag. So I got a lot of insults and threats, and it's still happening today. You know, when I look at my social media today, I'll have people saying very nasty expletives to me and very nasty words to me. But that's part of being in public life. I accept that. And these people aren't really fans of the show. because they would realise it's not about me or Ed or Ant, it's about the car. All we want to do is restore cars. And I'd be doing this anyway if the cameras weren't turning and I wasn't making this show. For the last 7 months, when the cameras haven't been turning, I've been restoring cars. This is what I do for a living. So we either film it or we don't. And I decided after 13 years of my life on this programme and getting it to where it is on a global stage, I'm not willing to give up on it just because Ed China decided to leave. And Discovery Channel are fully committed to making this the best show we possibly can be. It's one of the biggest car shows in the world, and we're determined to carry on to that end. We're going to make it an even bigger car show because we're going to have better products, better cars, a different way of doing it, and a different dynamic.
Let's go back to the beginning then, Mike. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in South London, Brixton, and I'm very much a Londoner at heart. I still am. I still got, you know, a house in London, and we still got our ties in London. I still pay my tax in London. You know, that's a good thing to say as well. Me and my wife Michelle, we employ 150 people in the UK, and our life is very much there. We're just in Hollywood making this show for entertainment.
And you're the youngest of six. Did that make you an attention seeker?
It did. Yeah, I think being the youngest of six, you really do have to use your elbows and jump and shout to get noticed. I think my mum would be the first to admit that by the time she had me, she'd given up. You know, she was like tired of bringing up five other kids. And by the time she got to her six, she thought, well, maybe the other five could just look after him for me. Because, you know, I had to shout my way to the top. And I've always been, I was tiny as a child, a really small, underdeveloped young man. And because of that, I had to become louder in other ways and more vocal in other ways. And having five siblings around you gives you a sense of confidence that you can conquer the world. And I've learned a lot from my family over the years, including my dad, who's an amazing guy. And that's where Mike Brewer comes from. I come from this very much London-centric family that gather around and, all pull together. And we were very much like that throughout my youth until I got to that leaving school age. And it was, you know, they literally kicked me out the door and said, go and make your way in life. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
How did you do at school?
I did pretty well, actually. I was the class clown, inevitably. So I was always the one in trouble with the school teacher. My school teachers always told me I would fail in life. I'd never make anything of myself. I was useless. But come my last year at school, I think it was fifth year then, I got O-levels in both English, maths, arts, geography and history. And I left school with really good academia. And I went straight into working for the print industry where I printed record sleeves. And then I went on to magazine publishing where I worked for Auto Car, Motor Magazine. So I got to know cars, and by the time I was 18, my dad was a car customizer, and my life was surrounded with vehicles and cars. So that's where I come from. You know, again, that's part. You put that together with the ingredients of my family, and you end up with Mike Brewer.
And your dad was a car customizer. So what did that involve?
Well, my dad was an incredible car customizer. He made some amazing cars in the 70s and early 80s that become quite famous. And I noticed back then that my dad was getting headlines on magazines and getting cover shots of magazines for some of the cars that he created. As a young, impressionable 10-year-old to a 14-year-old lad, that didn't really mean much. I was just dragged around classic car shows and custom car shows and made to look at this stuff reluctantly. But it wasn't until I became sort of 18 and started to take an interest in cars personally, that I realized I learned so much from my dad. I learned about paintwork, about how to look for accident damage, how to look for interior trim, how to make sure a car is straight and tidy. And that all helped me in becoming a really good car dealer.
And what was the first car you owned?
It was, and I'd love to find it. If it's out there, please find it for me.
What's the registration? Maybe somebody knows.
Everyone can remember their first love and their first registration. It was GJJ550J. So it was a little Erin A. Beige Mini 1000 that overheated wherever it went. And I think when I got in that car, I probably drove to the moon and back, because my mum said, when I got my driver's license at 18 years of age. She never see me again. I just disappeared. And that was it. I was off. I travelled around England. I went to every nightclub, every disco, every seaside resort you could possibly think of, and just enjoyed the experience of being free behind the wheel of a little Mini. I loved it.
What did you pay for it?
I remember I paid £300 for it. My sister's neighbour reversed into it and damaged it and broke my heart. The insurance company wrote it off. I bought it back off the insurance company for £25. And me and my dad, who was a car customiser, pulled the damage out, repaired it, repainted it. I put new wheels on it and I sold it for £800. And I was thinking, wow, I've earned more in a car deal than my dad did in a month, you know, back then. So I'm going to do this again. So I then thought I can do this for a living. You know, I can buy and sell cars. And that was it. That was my foray into the world of car dealing. And I've never stopped since. You know, now through Mike Brewer Motors, me and Michelle, we sell 350 cars a month. You know, I've never stopped doing it.
Then television came along much, much later. I think the first car show I saw you on was Deals on Wheels. Was that the first telly you did?
Yeah, that was 1997. I know we're getting old, aren't we? So I got approached by Channel 4 to do a show called Deals and Wheels. It very quickly became Channel 4's biggest factual format in their history since they'd launched. By the third week of it being on screen, it got recommissioned again for a second run. And during the second run, I got headhunted by the then Top Gear, which meant inevitably that Channel 4 had a fight over my contract. And I'll be honest with you, I've never stopped making TV every week since then. Since 1997, I've made television every week of my life.
You say you were approached by them. You were well known as a car dealer then in South London?
Yes, I was. It's kind of, you know, and that's to be on television and to be a car dealer, you really, really don't want to have skeletons in your closet. You really want to be good. And I had a fantastic reputation in London at that time of being a really good, honest, straightforward car dealer. So when I got approached by Channel 4, I spoke to my then girlfriend, Michelle, who's now my wife. And I said to her, you know, should we do this? And she said, no. You know, why would you give up? Why would you tell people your tips about how you're a good car dealer on screen? Because they could portray you being a nasty guy. So we kept turning them down. We turned Channel 4 down for several months until they eventually made the show Deals on Wheels and then contacted me and said, rather than be featured in the program, can we use you as a host, as a presenter of the show? So I went in for a screen test and they gave me the job on the spot. And I presented the show for them. I'd never done it before in my life. And that was the start of my illustrious television career.
And what was the hardest thing about learning to be a television presenter?
You know what? It wasn't the hardest thing. The only thing you have to be about being a television presenter is just be yourself. Just be honest, be true to yourself, and don't pretend to be anything that you're not. You know, for the last 20 years of my career, I'm inundated with people contacting me saying, you don't say three right, or you speak, you shouldn't say me and Ed, you should say Ed and I, trying to correct my grammar and trying to correct the way that I speak. And I think, stuff you, I've made a career out of speaking the way I do, you know, and I'm not going to change. I've never changed for, you know, the directors and the producers that have tried to correct me in the past. And I've made a pretty good success out of my life, and I'm not going to change it. You know, I am who I am, and that's what people buy into. I am a real, genuine, honest guy that loves what I do. I love my craft. I love TV. I love people. And I love the emotion of getting a car from a sorry state into an amazing state and giving it to somebody else to enjoy. That's what I do, and long may it continue. No, I'm never. So the biggest tip for anyone who wants to get in TV is just don't change. Just be yourself.
You've presented a lot of shows on TV. There was Pulling Power, there was Driven, but you're best known for Wheeler Dealers. How did you get that gig?
So Wheeler Dealers came about in 2003. I had just finished a run on Driven. I was working for Discovery Channel making a gadget show called He's Gotta Have It. Which was the precursor to the now famous Gadget Show. And I made that show for him for 2 years, and it was during that period of time I got headhunted again by Top Gear to go and make, which is now or was the current version of Top Gear with Clarkson, Hammond and May. And I got headhunted to do that show. And at the time, it was rubbish, Top Gear. Nobody wanted to do it. It was like the Poison Chalice. And I turned it down. And I turned it down after two big screen tests with Clarkson. I turned it down twice. And ultimately, they asked me, you know, if it's not going to be you, who's it going to be? And I found Richard Hammond for them. Richard's forgotten that, unfortunately, over the years. But I did find Richard Hammond for the BBC. He was a Renault press officer at the time. And I pointed Richard in a direction of the BBC and Andy Wilman. And that show went off to become its own success. And at the same time, there was a little production company working for Discovery Channel called Attaboy, and they were bounding around a car format called Grand Autos, which was buying a car for a grand, fixing them and selling them. And they asked my permission to attach my name to it, and I said, yes, go ahead. And the Wheeler Dealers, it then became Wheeler Dealers because I own a company called Wheeler Dealers, so they named it after me. And then it started off as this tiny little show on this little weedy network in the UK with a tiny little budget. And by the end of the first run, it had grown an audience big enough to outperform every other show on that network. And that happened consistently then for every season that we made, until eventually by 2008, it was outperforming the biggest shows on Discovery Channel by some considerable margin. So they moved us across to Discovery Global, and that's when the show hit a global audience. And now we have over 200 million people watch us around the world in 217 territories. And they say it's one of the biggest car shows, if not the biggest car show in the world currently.
When you watch the show, it looks like you have all the fun going around the world buying and selling the cars, and Ed gets stuck in the workshop doing all the work. But it can't be like that. I mean, you must have a big input into it.
Yeah, I do. It's not like that. I'm one of the producers of the programme, so I put a lot into the back room of Wheeler Dealers. I've got my current producer sitting next to me, as you know, driving, and he'd probably nod his head in agreement. I put a lot into the back room of Wheeler Dealers. And also, what a lot of people don't know is when the cameras are cut, I'm doing a lot of the mechanicking and helping out with the mechanicking. Last season, you got to see that on screen. That was when Ed wanted to do other things and work less. So the show needs to get made. So you would have seen me appear on screen a bit more doing some of the mechanicking. I've always done some, so you might as well show that I do it. And that's what happened last time. But we're not going to do that again, because now we've got a new mechanic that wants to be on, wants to do all the mechanics. So, yeah, I put a lot into Wheeler Dealers. A lot of it comes out of my head, out of my brain. Right now, you know, I'm out finding cars. You know, I was yesterday I did a 14-hour day. Today I was up at 6. I think, you know, by the time we end today, it'll be another 14-hour day. And that's sometimes 7 days a week on Wheeler Dealers. It's a hard show to make. It's a global show, and it means that I have to travel extensively and make a lot of sacrifices in terms of my personal life. So a lot of people would say, oh, you don't do anything, you know, you've got the easy job, Ed does all the hard work. I'd swap with those people any day of the week so they could see what I get up to. And for the mechanic, he just turns up every day at the workshop at 9 o'clock and finishes at 5. So I would argue it's the other way round. You know, they get the easy job and I get the hard stuff, having to go out and find the cars and find the parts and find the customers.
More from Mike Brewer in 2 weeks' time. Hear about the time he was in a war zone, in a helicopter, and came under fire. That's all coming up in part two of my chat with Mike Brewer. Next week, it's an actor you should be familiar with, Dominic Monaghan, English actor who now lives in Los Angeles. You've probably seen him in Lord of the Rings, or know him best as Charlie from Lost. Dominic Monaghan, my guest next week, right here on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. What about your Skype details? I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.